What is important for organisations is not to become over-fixated on the threats. That's necessary, obviously, to have a good defence. But also to figure out this whole notion of resilience. How quickly could we get our systems back up and running? How quickly could we get our organisation functioning again? How are we going to recover our data? Where are we storing it? Those sorts of things.
You're listening to the ISF Podcast for your organization's better cybersecurity. Your host, ISF CEO Steve Durbin, is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. British journalist Juliet Foster recently interviewed Steve for an exclusive feature in The European, and today we hear their conversation. Steve and Juliet explore a range of topics, including how to get buy-in to your security strategy at all levels of the organization, how much security should cost, navigating the regulatory landscape, and which industries and enterprises Steve looks at as templates for good security.
It's very good to see you, Steve. And let me just start with a very general question. Do you believe that organizations are more aware of the value of a good cybersecurity strategy? Has that awareness increased?
Yes, Juliet, and nice to talk to you. Yes, I think it has. I think if you look back over, say, the last 2 to 3, maybe 5 years, then the level of awareness has certainly increased. I think we've got COVID and the pandemic to thank a little bit for that, because that forced a number of changes and moving everybody from in an office environment to home or remote working really shone the light on the need to implement a whole range of different security processes and controls that I think if that hadn't happened, people wouldn't have been as aware. And I think I'm saying that when I look not just at large companies, because of course large companies have been aware of the need for security for quite some while, but also across the mid-size and indeed into smaller enterprises. So I think people are more aware. I think that the issue really is all about how they then derive value. That's the key. So the awareness, yes, that's increased. Are we any better at demonstrating the real value of security to an organization in the way that perhaps business leaders would like to see it? I think there's still probably a way to go in that regard.
So from the perspective of the Information Security Forum, what is a good cyber strategy? And the bottom line is, what should it look like in practice?
Yeah, I mean, I get asked this question quite a lot. You know, what's a good strategy? And the answer is really a good strategy is one that meets the needs of the business. And there's a whole range of different things that we can talk about in there. But the crux of a good cyber strategy is having an alignment with the business strategy, having an alignment with what it is that the organization is looking to do on a daily basis, which in the majority of cases is, you know, increase revenue, increase shareholder value, deliver back to employees, customers, and to further the ideals of the organization. And because there isn't an organization out there that I'm aware of today that isn't dependent in some way, shape, or form on technology and therefore on data, security is embedded in everything that we do. So a good strategy from a cyber perspective is totally aligned with the organizational direction, is quantifiable in terms of the way in which it delivers on that corporate strategy. And everybody in the organization is very aware of not just the role that cyber plays in the strategy, but also of their individual role in helping to implement it. So that's sort of, you know, what it looks like at the strategic level. Are organizations close to achieving that? Yes, in some parts of the world, in some parts of our membership, they are. Others, of course, are on that journey and some are just starting out.
Let's look at the issue of implementation. Who should be responsible for that area, implementing a cyber strategy? Because in the old days, the assumption was that it should be left in the hands of the technology people. Should the strategy be all-encompassing? In other words, where everyone is responsible for keeping a business safe, so it becomes a moral responsibility.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that everybody has a responsibility. You know, we all use technology in some way, shape, or form. And because we do that, we all have a responsibility. And it isn't just about, I think, preserving corporate assets. It's also about preserving personal assets, because, of course, there is this blend that we've seen between how we use technology for, you know, personal things and indeed in corporate. So it's impossible, I think, at the moment to draw a line between the two things and have some degree of separation between that. And because of that, everybody is responsible for it. To the point about, do we hand it off to company techies? Again, I would say not. I would say that actually the responsibility for setting the direction and setting the tone, the culture, and the way in which cyber is driven through an organization is clearly the responsibility of the chief executive and the board of directors. That's where the tone has to be set. And it all then flows down from there. That doesn't mean that security leaders will get an open checkbook to do whatever they like. And it doesn't mean that technical people are excluded. The nice thing, I think, from a cultural standpoint about security is it does have the ability to bring companies together, because it's probably one of the few things that people can actually relate to right the way across an enterprise. And so I think there is an immense opportunity that we have to really set the cultural tone of an organization, provided that we've got that buy-in, provided that we've got that direction, that guidance, that oversight from the very top as to the way in which security is implemented right the way across the enterprise.
But are you also concerned that perhaps in some instances there is a misalignment between cybersecurity priorities and business outcomes?
Yes, I am. And I think that's an area that we all need to work much harder on. And, you know, it normally comes about because we haven't spent the time at the outset to really align those two areas. And that's for a variety of different reasons. In a lot of cases, security is brought in at the last minute. So we try to retrofit security. Now, I always talk about the need to involve security right at the beginning of any project. It doesn't matter what it is, even if all they're doing is saying, yes, we don't have a role to play, because at least you're sending the right message and you're covering yourself at the right time in any sort of project implementation. But alignment also plays to the fact that we should be speaking a common language across the organization. And all too often, I think, security leaders and their teams fall into the trap of talking about things in a language that they understand, but which actually is quite alien to the business. And that really doesn't progress anything. So I'll give you an example, for instance. We at the ISF recommend that organizations conduct a very regular series of benchmarks and health checks just to see how all of the controls and the policies and so on are comparable with standards that are evolving, regulation, and indeed other organizations. And all too often I see those being fed back by security people in technical terms. So a score might be provided, but the time isn't taken to explain what that actually means, what it means from a strategic standpoint, what it means from a business perspective. So there's an alienation that goes on immediately, because whilst we might have got a very good benchmark that's been conducted, if we can't then use that tool and describe it effectively to business leaders as to what that means for them in a language that they understand, alienation is going to be inherent in everything that we do. And so we need to spend better time doing that. That requires a higher degree of emotional intelligence on the security side to explain some of these things. And it also requires, I think, on the business side, an understanding of the fact that they're going to have to go a little bit further, perhaps, than they have done in understanding some of the implications. So if you're a sales leader, it isn't just about how you can deliver revenue. It's what are the implications, for instance, of using a CRM system? You know, if security is telling you that some of your people shouldn't be accessing the systems remotely from a coffee shop or an airport, then digging into why that might be. You may still override that from a security perspective because you're the business leader. You know your sales team requires that access. But understanding what the downsides, what the risks are, is a fundamental component in you deciding your go-to-market strategy and how that might be implemented by your sales team. So, you know, there are some very simple things, I think, that we've taken for granted over the years that have embedded themselves in organizations simply because organizations evolve. And we haven't had perhaps to worry as much about security as we now need to right the way across the board. You know, the financial services sector has always been concerned because people have always wanted to attack them. So they're at a particularly advanced and developed stage from a security standpoint. But there are other organizations that aren't, and for whom some of the things we're talking about now are probably relatively new.
But clearly there are implications for leadership. So given that, how do you think that leaders can ensure everybody, no matter where they are in the company structure, indeed, no matter who they are, buys into the importance of that security concept, and they feel emotionally invested, so that protecting a business is a genuine collective effort.
You've got to make it personal. You know, I have to understand what the implications are for me. And so that means if you're running phishing tests or you're looking at awareness, for instance, you provide feedback in the moment. So if you're running a phishing test and I click on something that I shouldn't, it's absolutely no good waiting a fortnight to then review that with me. I need to get that feedback in the moment. Now, a lot of those simulations and things are built into the products that we use, they're built into the processes. But I can't stress enough this need for the personal involvement. If you look at things like cyber simulation exercises, again, it's about making it personal. It isn't just about the way in which an organization continues to survive and work through a cyber attack. It's the role that the individual has to play. So what does it mean for me at that level? And then I become emotionally involved because I can understand the way in which I need to either be engaged or indeed in some instances not engaged. You know, there are certain people that you certainly don't want being involved partway through a breach or an attack because it's not their job. So I think that the emotional investment piece has to be about making it personal. And that will be different things at different stages in the organization. So for instance, if you happen to be in a partnership, then clearly any amount of money that is invested is the partner's money. So there's a personal investment there. So you're going to have to play a very different game there in terms of justifying some of the costs associated with security than perhaps in a limited company where there isn't that same level of personal investment at a cash level, but there will be others in terms of the moral obligation of a company director, the ethical role of a company director, you know, conformance with good governance, all of those sorts of things. So it's about, I think, identifying what it is that is really going to pull some of those heartstrings and then aligning the security concepts, the security rollout, the implementation, the communication to hit on all of those so that people, first of all, understand and then can play their role.
And again, from your perspective as a security expert, how often do you think cybersecurity strategies should be tested, given that the threat numbers are constantly evolving? And I guess that there is that fear of not being able to keep across them.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that there's no doubt that threats are continuing to increase, will continue to increase, will become very much more complex. We're looking at things like the advent of artificial intelligence. We're looking at potential things like quantum computing. And then we're also talking about some of those well-worn threats that are still very, very effective, you know, ransomware, phishing scams, deep fakes, all of this kind of stuff. It's all out there. It's all alive and kicking. So how often should organizations sort of review their overall strategy? Well, you need to be doing some of the tactical things on a very regular basis. So policy reviews, you know, they need to be happening regularly, probably every 12 months. We're now beginning to move into a much more highly regulated environment, irrespective of which vertical sector you happen to be working in. So again, keeping an eye on what the regulators are saying, what legislation is doing. Interestingly, you know, one of the security leader's best friends has now become the chief legal officer. And I don't know that we would have said that a number of years ago, because I think the chief information security officer and the legal counsel need to be working almost hand in glove on some of these things to make sure that companies are being protected appropriately. Then we need to be testing our defenses. That needs to happen at least once a year. So, you know, cybersecurity simulation exercises, I would say, should happen at least every 12 months and monitor the way in which it's evolved, your response, and how you might want to change that. And it's a good idea to bring in a third party to help you understand those things and not do it just based off paper, off tick box, but actually go through a fairly comprehensive program of testing your defenses right the way from the board level down to business leaders and those who are responsible for implementation. And we do that on a regular basis with our member companies who are very active in that space, as you would indeed hope.
Mm. I mean, how much does it cost to not just implement a good strategy, but maintain it?
You know, I often get asked that question. And in the beginning, I started to come up with percentages, you know, a percentage of investment in technology, for instance, which was quite a common way of looking at it. So if you're spending, you know, I don't know, 5% of revenue on technology, then what percentage of that should be spent on security? And, you know, I came to the conclusion that it was probably a bit of a fool's errand, because you're plucking these numbers out of the ether that absolutely have no bearing on the state of maturity or development or risk profile or appetite of the organization. So the answer really is, how long's a piece of string? You have to look at how concerned you are about protecting your crown jewels. And I think all too often, particularly at the moment where, you know, organizations are very careful about how they spend their money, we have to be realistic. So we have to say, you know, the starting point always has to be, what do I absolutely have to protect in order to keep my business running? That then forms your crown jewels. You have to protect those. You can't put a cost on that. That's an essential. And then you roll it down from there. And there will be certain things that, as you get further and further away from the absolutely core essential things that need to be protected, that you probably in some years will take a decision not to do anything about. So I think that when, you know, chief information security officers, when chief security officers are looking at putting together their budgets, it's hugely important for them to look at it from that perspective, because there isn't a business out there that wants to fail. And most board directors that I talk to are acutely aware of the dangers of cybersecurity and not implementing it correctly across their enterprise. They're very aware of threats at a personal level, but what they don't understand is how security budgets and the costs associated with implementing some of these things relate back to protecting the organization and, you know, as I said earlier, furthering the overall corporate strategy. So the role of the security leader, you know, in any budget cycle is to try to align whatever spend she or he wishes to have with the future direction of travel of that organization. And if you can start to do that, then the whole conversation becomes very much easier. But I'm not a huge fan of setting fairly random percentages, because I think it sends entirely the wrong message. You run the risk of overspend or underspend. And what you actually want to be doing is spending appropriately to deliver the right level of protection for your critical assets, for your company, for your employees, for your shareholders, so that you can continue to provide a thriving environment.
In one of your answers a few moments ago, in fact, you mentioned the word regulation, and you can't have a conversation about security issues without referencing the regulation landscape. And yep, given that, how can businesses keep up with regulation and the pressures to update their security, especially if they're operating across multiple geographies?
Yeah, it's a difficult one. It really is. And I think it's one, you know, the bad news is one is going to become even more complex, because we're not going to see regulation slowing down. I think the other thing I would say, broadly speaking, is that regulation is always going to lag the way in which the market is developing, because regulators traditionally have always been a bit reluctant to try to anticipate the way in which a market will evolve. So that is certainly an area I think that everybody that I speak to is very concerned about, because we seem to be moving away from consistency to much more local, geographical regulation. And there's a number of reasons for that. If you look at artificial intelligence, for instance, if you just look at things like the EU's most recent AI Act, then member states are currently looking at that. And there's an approach that's been put forward within that act about protecting the way in which data is managed and putting some constraints, some would say, around the way in which vendors and research and development might take place around AI. If you look at the UK has taken a slightly more open and relaxed approach to it. Now, the cynic would say that the reason for that is there's a tremendous amount of money involved in AI, of course, and if you can have regulation that is more light touch, then you'll encourage more investment in some of these emerging technologies. So I use that only as an example to demonstrate that we've now moved into a world in which we're no longer talking about some fairly simplistic security components. We're no longer talking about regulation to just protect or set the guidelines. We've moved into a political area where we're trying to encourage investment, where we're trying to create the right atmosphere for organizations to work in your country, the right atmosphere where you want to attract perhaps digital nomads, you know, to work in your country. And so the whole environment, when we look at it, is evolving. And if I go back, I don't know, maybe 5 years, you know, we'd got to a point where regulation was becoming a little bit more standardized. We had things like GDPR, for instance, which was seen as being a bit of a gold standard that a lot of countries were aspiring to use as the bar when it comes to privacy. And I think that we're moving away from that now to a degree perhaps of protectionism, where some regulation is being used for political purposes, and that will only make life very much more complex for organizations, perhaps not so much for the multinationals, because they do have, you know, fairly large legal departments. We've seen the way in which some large American vendors have gone head to head with the European Union, and indeed continue to do so. But it makes for a very difficult trading condition for the mid-size and small companies who are trying to operate outside of a simple jurisdiction, particularly if they're in the supply chain of some of these multinationals, because they're getting sucked into some of this. So the cost associated with trying to conform to this ever-shifting regulatory set of sands, if I could put it that way, I think is one that we need to, yes, be concerned about. There's no easy answer. The answer is only for governments, regulators, private sector to actually get together and try and figure out what makes most sense. And we've seen some of that trying to come about in the United States as well. But I think the whole regulatory area is one that will continue to evolve. It's going to get more complex. That means it's going to get more difficult for smaller to mid-sized organizations to operate cost effectively. And I think that, being a lawyer is probably not a bad option.
Would you say that investors are probably more receptive to those companies which do have credible cyber strategies, that they feel more comfortable throwing in their money if there is evidence that these businesses are doing all the right things?
I'd love to think so. Sadly, I don't think that's the case at all. I think that investors, you know, are clearly interested in a return on investment. And I'm not being critical of them. That's what they're in the business to do. I think that, you know, again, if I look back, gosh, about 15 years ago, I used to do a tremendous amount of merger and acquisition work. And there was no way that we would ever include in that M&A assessment anyone from security. It never came across the radar in any way, shape or form. Here we are 15 years down the road, and it happens occasionally, but we're still not at a point where security is seen as being instrumental in that. And there've been a number of different instances where people have caught cold because they've invested in an organization. Maybe they've acquired it, maybe they've merged, and then things have gone badly wrong because they hadn't paid attention to some of those security things. So I think that certainly lights are starting to go on, but I don't think we're anywhere close to this idea that an investor will put money into an organization having done a fairly thorough review of the security strategy and some of the risk implications associated with it. I think that there are other things involved when making an investment that far outweigh, rightly or wrongly, you know, the role that security has to play in that.
And without naming names, are there particular companies whose approach to cybersecurity has impressed you? And do you feel that their approach provides a possible template for others to follow?
Yeah, there are. I mean, I think that I would have to point to probably two sectors or groups of organizations. I think some in financial services. Certainly, you know, financial services have necessarily needed to be concerned about security for quite some while. That's because of regulation, as we've discussed, is because of the need for compliance, and it's because there's a lot of money sloshing around in that, and clearly they are good targets for any cyber criminal, so they necessarily need to be more advanced in that. So I think there are some organizations there that I would point to, and the characteristics of that are, as I've mentioned, it's a commitment from the very top of the organization, from board of directors, chief executive, right the way down, to talking about the role that security has to play in terms of ensuring the effectiveness of the organization. And it's about delivering on that as well. So making sure that there are key performance indicators that play to that. So, you know, you're measuring and reducing some of the exposure that you've got on an ongoing basis. So I think that's very important. So there are some organizations there that I think provide a very good template at the larger end. Then I think the other group that I would sort of focus on or draw attention to is some of the new emerging companies. So it's very much easier if you're building an organization from the ground up to be able to implement security controls, have an effective security strategy that evolves and grows with you, rather than trying to retrofit something to an organization that's been in business for 30, 40, 50, hundreds of years, perhaps. And so I've seen a number of those smaller organizations, startup organizations, very fast growth, that have completely embraced the need to protect intellectual property, and so have implemented some fairly robust security processes and have a very coherent and cohesive security strategy that everybody buys into, because that is simply the way that we do business, if you look at it that way. And so I think that those are the two ends of the spectrum, if you like.
And looking to the future, what are the key threats that organizations need to be aware of? And has the prevalence of AI made the security situation more dangerous?
The threat landscape continues to evolve. There's no question about that. Cyber criminals, threat actors, state-backed criminals, they're all out there. They will all continue to be out there. Anybody in security will be able to point to the number of attempts, you know, to breach corporate defenses on a daily basis, and the number they'll be able to show you increases, you know, day after day, week after week, year after year. So we know that it's becoming more difficult out there, and that organizations need to be constantly vigilant and keep abreast of evolving threats. But there are some consistent ones that we're seeing. You know, malware, that's never going to go away. Ransomware, that's never going to go away. Phishing, very effective way of dropping some of these things like malware and ransomware into an organization. That's not going to go away anytime soon. And these are some of the basic things. Now, the fact that we're seeing some things recurring year on year means that if we have the right controls in place, if we continue to update our technology infrastructure, if we continue to stay abreast of what's happening from a threat intelligence standpoint, we're in a pretty good place. Then if we move into the realm of AI, well, we're not seeing at the moment anyway, any significant AI-generated threats. So the concern is always, and we talk about this a lot in our Threat Horizon program that looks forward 2 years, you know, we've been talking about it for about the last 5 to 6 years, the way in which AI will evolve and may be used to boost the way that some of the threats are being dropped on organizations. But we're not seeing that yet. Now, my concern is that there are probably, in some parts of the world, some fairly sophisticated threat actors that are working on the way in which AI may be used. And that we will probably see zero-day exploits in the next couple of years that are benefiting from the use of AI. And so what does that mean? Well, it means that from a security standpoint, we too need to be looking at how we can use AI to increase the robustness of our defenses and to improve our resilience. But, you know, it isn't just about trying to prevent an attack. For me, if you're in the crosshairs and somebody really wants to attack you, they will, and they'll get through, particularly if you're in a particularly attractive industry, whether that be perhaps national infrastructure, financial services, whatever it might be. What is important for organizations is not to become over fixated on the threats. That's necessary, obviously, to have a good defense, but also to figure out this whole notion of resilience. How quickly could we get our systems back up and running? How quickly could we get our organization functioning again? How are we going to recover our data? Where are we storing it? Those sorts of things. So moving into that whole realm of business continuity, recovery, that's where I think we need to spend a lot of time as well. And we need to be testing those things. So it isn't just about being fixated on the threats. It's about also making sure that our organizations are in good shape to get back up and running and to really continue to provide service to the organizations that depend on us for doing that. And also, of course, you know, livelihoods for the people that work within those organizations.
Are more companies joining ISF because AI has heightened those risks that you've outlined?
I wouldn't say that it's directly because of AI. I think that certainly our members And our members, you know, are from organizations that in Australia, right the way across through Asia, Africa, Middle East, right the way through Europe and into the Americas. So it's a truly global membership base and a mix again of multinationals with mid-size and smaller enterprises and indeed government institutions. So they're not joining just because of AI. I think they're joining because they recognize that the original founding principles of the ISF, which was about community, which was about sharing, which was about the belief that by combining the perspectives, the viewpoints, the capabilities of member organizations all around the world, each individual member organization would benefit because the vast experience that was available for them was so much greater than they would ever be able to acquire themselves. So I think they're joining for that. I think they're joining because we have a number of very advanced tools that they can use, particularly in the area of things like supplier management, supplier security assessment, risk assessment, benchmarking. And the other thing about the ISF is this is all we do. You know, we don't do anything other than security and risk management. That's it. And so we're pretty good at it. And I think that, you know, that's why people are joining us. That's why they want to work with us and our member community. And we're always keen to try to make sure that we are delivering value to our members, whatever that looks like for the member at whatever stage of evolution and development they happen to be, whether it be supporting them in the boardroom or whether it be supporting them at the practitioner level. And we do that by remaining, you know, very current and active with standard bodies all around the world, providing input to government around regulation. And really trying, I think, without lobbying, because I wouldn't ever want to get into that, but really trying to provide a bit of an industry voice from an objective and independent perspective.
I think that's a very positive note on which to end.
Our thanks to Juliet Foster and to The European. We'll be back next week with a new episode. If you found value in the conversation today, please rate and review the podcast and share this episode. To become a member, get in touch with Steve directly at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or on LinkedIn at Steve Durbin. Check out all our media and resources. All of it is there to support you at securityforum.org. Don't miss the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, sharing conversations with members about the real-world applications of ISF research. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox Productions and Tavia Gilbert. Thanks for listening.